You're listening to Radio Hangar Aviation Talk, powered by AI, fueled by passion. This is The Hangar. I'm Taildragger. And today, folks, we're going to talk about the fastest motorsport you've never sat in a grandstand for. We're talking about the Reno Air Races. Pylon racing at 400 miles an hour, 50 feet off the desert floor, with nothing between you and eternity but a pair of hands on the stick and a whole lot of nerve. Pull up a chair. This one's a good one. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. It's September 1964. You're standing in the high desert outside Reno, Nevada. The sagebrush smells sharp in the morning air. The sun is already brutal, even though it's barely 9 o'clock. And off in the distance you hear it, that unmistakable sound, a Merlin engine at full song. Not the polished hum you hear at an air show flyby. No, this is a Merlin being absolutely flogged, wide open, screaming. The sound hits you in the chest before the airplane even clears the ridge. That was the year it all started. Well, started again, really. And to understand why Reno became the cathedral of air racing, you've got to go back even further. Air racing in America goes all the way back to 1920. The Pulitzer Trophy races, the Bendix Trophy, the Thompson Trophy, back in the 20s and 30s, air racing was as big as baseball. Guys like Jimmy Doolittle, Roscoe Turner with that wax mustache and his pet lion, and the great Jacqueline Cochran were household names. These were the rock stars of their age. They flew souped-up biplanes and early monoplanes around closed courses marked by pylons, and the crowds went absolutely wild for it. But then the war came. World War II put a stop to most civilian air racing, and after the war, things changed. The jet age arrived. The military wasn't interested in piston engines anymore. The national air races that had been held in Cleveland kind of sputtered out by 1949 after a P-51 Mustang crashed into a house during the Thompson Trophy race and killed a spectator. That tragedy, more than anything, shut the door on organized air racing in America for over a decade. Now here's where it gets interesting. A fella named Bill Stead, rancher pilot, Nevadan through and through. Bill loved to fly and he loved to race. He'd been running what he called the National Championship Air Races as a small local event near Reno, starting in 1961, with mostly small formula racers, little airplanes with little engines going around pylons at maybe 200 miles an hour. Fun to watch, but not exactly hair-raising. But Bill Stead had a bigger vision. He wanted to bring back the glory days. He wanted the big iron, the Warbirds, the Mustangs, and the Bearcats, and the Sea Furies. The airplanes that won the war turned loose on a race course, with no speed limit and no apologies in 1964. The unlimited class was born at Reno, and that changed everything. Now let me explain how pylon racing works, because unless you've seen it, it's hard to grasp just how insane this is. You take a course laid out in the desert, roughly 8 to 9 miles around, marked by pylons. These pylons are telephone poles with 55-gallon drums painted bright colors sitting on top of them. The airplanes fly around this course at race altitude, which is as low as 50 feet above the ground, at speeds that can exceed 500 miles per hour in the unlimiteds. They bank around the pylons at 60-70 degrees of bank. The G-forces in those turns can hit 6-7 Gs, and there's no straightaway where you coast. It's full power, full commitment, every single lap. If you cut inside a pylon, you get a penalty. They call it a mayday cut. You get scored as though you flew a wider course. So the incentive is to fly as tight to those pylons as humanly possible while going as fast as the airplane will allow.
And remember, these are modified warbirds. We're not talking about stock P-51 Mustangs. These are airplanes that have been modified within an inch of their lives, clipped wings, cut down canopies, engines that have been boosted and tweaked and tuned to produce 2,000, 3,000, sometimes over 4,000 horsepower from engines that were originally designed to put out maybe 1,500. The guys who build these race engines are artists, absolute artists. They take a Rolls-Royce Merlin V12 or a Pratt & Whitney R2800 radial, and they turn it into something that would make the original engineers either weep with pride or faint with horror, maybe both. Let me tell you about some of the legends. Daryl Greenamier. This man dominated the unlimited class in the late 60s and through the 70s. He flew a Bearcat, a Grumman F-8F Bearcat called Conquest I. Now, the Bearcat was originally a Navy fighter from the end of World War II, designed to be the fastest piston engine fighter the Navy ever built. Greenamier took that airplane and turned it into a missile. In 1969, he set the world speed record for piston engine aircraft at 483 miles per hour. Unofficially on the race course, he was going even faster than that. Greenamier was a test pilot by profession, worked for Lockheed. The man understood airplanes at a molecular level, and he was fearless, not reckless. There's a difference. Fearless means you understand exactly what the risks are and you accept them. Reckless means you don't know or don't care. Greenamier knew. He just decided the speed was worth it. Then there was Lyle Shelton. Shelton flew a Bearcat 2, a beautiful blue airplane called Rare Bear, and Rare Bear is probably the most famous race airplane in history. Shelton put a Wright R3350 engine in that thing. That's the engine from a Douglas Skyraider, a much bigger airplane. He shoehorned it into the Bearcat airframe with modifications that bordered on the miraculous. In 1989, Lyle Shelton flew Rare Bear to a world piston engine speed record of 528 miles per hour. That record stood for decades, 528 miles an hour, in a piston engine airplane with a propeller. Think about that for a minute. But the airplane most associated with Reno is the P-51 Mustang. And the most famous Mustang racer of them all might just be Strega. Strega, which is Italian for witch, was a highly modified P-51D owned and raced by the Tiger Di Stefani racing team. Piloted by the legendary Bill Tiger Di Stefani, Tiger won the unlimited gold championship at Reno seven times. Seven times. The man was in his 60s and still pulling 7Gs at 50 feet off the deck at 480 miles an hour. When you'd see Strega come around pylon 7 in a knife-edge turn, the wingtip practically kissing the sagebrush, the Merlin howling like something out of a fever dream, you'd understand why people drove across the desert every September to watch this spectacle. Strega had a racing engine that produced somewhere north of 3,500 horsepower. The stock Merlin in a wartime P-51 put out about 1,470. So we're talking about more than double the original power. The modifications to the cooling system alone were works of engineering genius. They used spray bars, special coolant mixtures, every trick in the book to keep that engine from melting itself during a race that lasted maybe 8 or 9 minutes of full power running. 8 or 9 minutes doesn't sound like much, but when you're running an engine at power levels it was never designed to sustain, those 8 minutes are an eternity. Every lap, you're wondering if the engine is going to hold together. Every lap, you're pulling G's that make your vision narrow and your arms feel like they're made of lead. Every lap, you're making split-second decisions about where to place the airplane relative to a pylon and 5 or 6 other airplanes going the same speed and fighting for the same piece of sky.
And it wasn't always warbirds. The race classes at Reno grew over the years. You had the biplanes flying beautiful pit specials and modified Mong Sports at around 200 miles an hour. You had the Formula One class, tiny little airplanes with Continental 0200 engines going around a shorter course. The T6 class running North American T6 Texan trainers in more or less stock configuration. The Sport class, which opened the door to Homebuilds and kit planes with modified engines, and eventually the Jet class running L-39 Albatross jet trainers. But the Unlimiteds were always the headliners, always. That's what people came to see. That's what made Reno, Reno. Now I need to talk about the darker side of this, because air racing at these speeds this close to the ground, with these kinds of power levels, is dangerous, genuinely, profoundly dangerous, and people have died. In 1998, Gary Levitz was killed when his P-51 broke apart during a race. The airplane came apart in flight. Think about the structural loads these airframes endure. These are 70-80-year-old airframes being subjected to forces they were never designed for. Lap after lap, year after year. Metal fatigues, structures weaken, and at 400 miles an hour when something lets go, it lets go catastrophically. The darkest day in Reno history came on September 16, 2011. A modified P-51 called the Galloping Ghost, piloted by veteran racer Jimmy Leeward, suffered a catastrophic trim tab failure during the Unlimited Gold race. The airplane pitched up violently, pulled off the course at high speed, and crashed into the spectator area near the grandstands. Jimmy Leeward was killed. 10 spectators were killed. Dozens more were injured. It was the worst air racing disaster in modern history. That accident shook Reno to its core. It shook all of aviation. There were serious questions about whether the races would ever come back. The National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, investigation found that a lock nut on the elevator trim tab had worked loose over time, allowing the tab to flutter and eventually depart the aircraft. The resulting pitch up was so sudden and so violent that no pilot could have recovered from it.
After that tragedy, the races did come back, but with enhanced safety measures. The spectator areas were moved further from the course. Inspection protocols were tightened. There were more restrictions on modifications. The racing community grieved, adapted, and pressed on, because that's what aviators do. We don't pretend the risks don't exist. We acknowledge them, we mitigate them, and we decide that the pursuit of flight, even at its ragged edge, is worth the cost. But the world was changing. Reno struggled financially in the years after 2011. The cost of maintaining vintage warbirds kept climbing. The pool of pilots willing and able to race modified fighters at 50 feet got smaller. Fewer warbird owners wanted to risk their increasingly valuable aircraft on the race course. A stock P-51 Mustang that might have sold for $300,000 in the 80s was now worth $2 million, $3 million or more. You think twice about racing a $3 million airplane. 50 feet off the desert at 400 miles an hour. In 2022, the Reno Air Racing Association announced that the 24th season at Stead Field would be the last. After 6 decades, the races at Reno were ending. The plan was to relocate to a new venue, and there was a brief run in a different location, but it was clear that an era was ending. I was lucky enough to attend Reno a handful of times over the years. And I'll tell you this, there is no experience in aviation quite like it, nothing. You stand on the ramp in the morning and the smell is jet exhaust and Avgas and sage and sunscreen. You hear the racers warming up, those Merlins and radials coughing and barking and then settling into that deep, thunderous idle. The ground shakes, you feel it in your teeth, and then they launch. The Pace airplane leads them around the course and then pulls up and calls out, "Gentlemen, you have a race." And those airplanes dive for the deck and the sound hits you like a wall. It's not a roar, it's a rip. It's the sound of propellers going supersonic at the tips. It's the sound of 12 cylinders turning 130 octane fuel into pure, ungoverned speed. You watch them come around the home pylon, and they're so close to the ground you wonder how they don't hit it. The wingtip vortices kick up little tornadoes of dust behind them, and they flash past you in a blur of color and noise, and before you can process what you just saw, they're already halfway around the course again. I remember watching a gold race 1 year, standing near pylon 8. Three Mustangs came through in a pack, wingtip to wingtip, jockeying for position. The lead airplane was maybe 40 feet off the ground. The trailing airplane was maybe 10 feet higher. They were so close together you could have thrown a baseball from one cockpit to the other, and they were going 450 miles an hour. The courage it takes, the skill, the sheer trust in your airplane and your ability. Back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, we had a saying, if you want to go fast, fly a jet. If you want to feel fast, fly low. At Reno, they did both. The legacy of the Reno Air Races is complicated. It's a story of extraordinary courage, engineering brilliance, and a love of speed that borders on obsession. It's also a story of loss of friends and heroes who didn't come home from the course. Every racer I ever spoke with understood that bargain. Every one of them would tell you the same thing. The flying was worth it. Reno proved that the warbirds weren't just museum pieces. They were living, breathing machines that could still perform at the absolute edge of what piston engine technology could deliver. The race teams and mechanics who kept those airplanes flying and competitive were some of the most talented aviation people who ever turned a wrench. Many of the techniques developed for racing those engines have found their way into experimental aviation and high-performance engine building. The engineering knowledge generated at Reno didn't die with the races. It lives on in shops and hangars all over the country, and the spirit of it lives on too. The idea that an airplane isn't just a vehicle, it's a challenge, a dare, a way of saying how fast can we go, how well can we fly, how close to the edge can we push this thing and still bring it home in one piece. That's what Reno was, that's what it will always be. For today's stories, I drew from the work of the Reno Air Racing Association's official histories, reporting by AVWeb and Air and Space Magazine, the NTSB accident reports, and the oral histories collected by the National Museum of the United States Air Force. This broadcast is AI-generated, created by pilots who love this stuff as much as you do. You can find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Thanks for pulling up a chair and hangar flying with me today. Go find a warbird. Touch the rivets. Smell the oil. Remember what those machines could do? Radio Hangar. Keep the blue side up.